Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock. This is a very special episode of The Critic Books podcast, as it was recorded for the centenary anniversary of James Joyce's Ulysses. This is a rather special episode of the Critic Books podcast. It's going to be released on the centenary of the publication of Ulysses by James Joyce, which is the 2nd of February 2022. And I'm joined by John McCourt and Richard Brown, who are both Joyceans. So John is Professor of English Literature and Head of the Department of Humanities at the University of Macerata, Italy. He is President of the International James Joyce Foundation, and his new book, Consuming Joyce, 100 Years of Ulysses in Ireland, is out this month. Richard Brown is a reader in modern literature at the University of Leeds and has published 4 books on James Joyce, and he also edits the James Joyce broadsheet. So I'm very excited to have you both here. Thank you so much for joining. Richard is actually here in Westminster with me, whereas John is on the Zoom airwaves.
Macerata.
So we're here to talk about Ulysses, but Ulysses is perhaps unjustly, famously thought of as pretty unreadable and very difficult. So if we have any listeners who haven't read Ulysses, or any listeners who don't know what Ulysses is about, could I ask maybe you, Richard, to give us a brief run through in fewer than 40 hours as to what happens in Ulysses?
That's a good one to start with. I think one of the wonderful things about Ulysses is that long as it is and complex as it is, then the basic idea of the book is just brilliantly simple. It's the account of a relatively small number of people on a single day in Dublin in 1904. And that's where all of the interest of the text begins. You know, how do you do that? How do you get a whole day into a book? Should it be a kind of narrative with a story where there's an event? Or should it really be a much more faithful record of what happens at particular hours in particular places during the course of that day? Should it be a spoken drama? Should it be about people's interactions? Well, Joyce's great innovation of literary modernism is to make it an inner drama, what happens inside people's minds. But then Joyce is an extraordinary writer, in as much as he's not really content even with that level of interest in his book. He's just fascinated to get almost anything you can imagine into the book during the course of the day. Yeah, extraordinary erudite writer. So really, by calling it Ulysses, he's alerting us to the fact that the whole history of Western European culture, back to Homer, somehow or other gets a look in this text, and in the consciousness of his everyday characters, whether they're Stephen Dedalus, the brilliant poet, intellectual, just graduated, hates his job as a teacher, not sure if he wants to stay in Ireland or go and see the world and life beyond. And Leopold Bloom, the married man, plotting his route around Dublin during the day whilst his wife pursues a musical career at home, and encountering the various adventures that he does in the various places he visits. I'm going to pause for breath.
I think you're doing pretty well. I think that probably encapsulates it quite enough. I think if we explain that it goes over 24 hours and so...
Not quite, but nearly 24 hours. Yeah, nearly 24 hours. So things happen in the night as well as in the day. It's an interesting point to make.
Yeah, would you say that was a fair summation, John?
I think that's pretty good, yeah. In 2 minutes. I mean, it's also a day in the life of the city of Dublin. And a day in the life of the world, if you like, because there's references to all sorts of things happening around the globe as they filter through the consciousness of Leopold and Molly, and indeed of Stephen Dedalus. So I think Richard did a pretty good job. We don't read Ulysses clearly for the plot. We read it for everything else, because the plot, as Richard has shown us, is pretty small and pretty inconsequential in a sense. Not inconsequential for Leopold and Molly Bloom,
But it's very domestic. It's about their domestic lives, their relationships. But if we're reading for the plot, we will stop reading very quickly. It's not a page turner in that way, I think it would be fair to say.
So if we've discovered that it's quite radical in the way that it makes a kind of inner dialogue its main mm-hmm. plot in a sense. Mm-hmm. And in 1922, it wasn't particularly well received by many of its first readers. John, do you want to talk about its beginning publication in Paris and then what happened after that and how Joyce kind of, well, if Leopold Bloom is an advertising man, Joyce was also an advertising man in advertising his own book.
Mm.
Mm. Well, the birth of Ulysses clearly was not easy, and Joyce had not made it easy for himself to be on the good side of publishers and, you know, reviewers in Ireland or beyond Ireland. And Dubliners and Portrait of the Artist, which had preceded it, had had fairly mixed reviews. Let's be fair. They were perhaps too truthful, too ahead of their time in their method, and too challenging to kind of the customary fictional rules of the time. And so Joyce had begun to publish Ulysses in serial form in the Little Review in the United States and also in the Egoist in Britain, and of course had famously run into trouble with, I think, the Nausicaa episode, which takes place on the beach where Leopold Bloom watches Gertie McDowell and the scene of masturbation, and it's all very exciting. Depending on if that's your thing. And of course, this caused great shock and horror, and even Joyce supporters like Ezra Pound felt it was too much. And so publication ceased. And because of that, Joyce found it very difficult to find a publisher willing to take his book on. And indeed, he had to go to France, where he was rescued by Sylvia Beach, who was willing to publish his book. But it was not a mass production. It was by subscription, and you got the book sent to you, and it was very expensive. So this certainly didn't facilitate the widespread diffusion of Joyce's work. But it became very much a cause célèbre. It was very much in the news, and Joyce was, as you said, quite an excellent self-publicist, and left no stone unturned in trying to, you know, raise awareness of his work, and indeed raise awareness of how he had been mistreated by critics at home and abroad, and by publishers. And of course, there was a lot of truth in that. So when Ulysses finally appears in 1922, it makes a big splash, a bigger splash than the number of copies that it actually sold. In fact, we know where a lot of the copies went. Some of them we still trace today. We know who bought them to some extent, or who were sent copies. And of course, the book was given lots of reviews. Many reviewers simply didn't know how to read the book. Still learning how to read the book, you could say. So there were some very appreciative, if rather vague, reviews. There were a number of reviews that were simply the reviewer hadn't read Ulysses. Because, you know, the time one is normally given to write a book review, you're told you've got a week or 10 days or 2 weeks. That's not the time frame you need to come to terms with the book of the complexity of Ulysses. So a lot of the reviews described what the book might be like, or what they imagined the book might be like. Some of the reviewers had already read segments in serialized versions, and others seriously engaged with the text and talked about what a revolution it actually was, how it was turning novel as we knew it inside out and breaking all the rules, creating something entirely new, which of course is the whole aim of the modernist movement, wasn't it? Make it new, as Ezra Pound said. Ulysses certainly made it new.
Made the English language new in many ways. So before we move on to talking about its later reception, perhaps there's something useful to be gained about what we talk about Ulysses being so radical and making it new mm-hmm. and at the height of modernism. It's also building off so much that comes before it. You already made the point that in calling itself Ulysses. Mm-hmm. Now, when we hear the title Ulysses, we think of the Joyce book, but readers in 1922 wouldn't have done. They would have thought of Homer, probably. And so maybe it's more radically different if we imagine it being called Hamlet or something. But if you want to talk about the influences that are on Joyce in his own text, mm-hmm. do you want to talk about the other things that appear throughout Ulysses? He's not just inventing things out of his own mind.
Ulysses is full of great one-liners, and one of them is that man of genius makes no mistakes. His errors are the portals of discovery, and your listeners might have just noted when John was talking about the book, he said, "No stone unturned," but he actually began "No stir," and it just occurs to me, he knows what I'm going to say now, that that in Ulysses there's no stone on stone. So Laurence Sterne, obviously one of the great innovators of the English novel, and even Sterne, you know, who you might think is one of the maddest and kind of most stoned writers in the 18th century, he's one of the writers who gets quite a big place in Joyce's imagination and gets transformed in Joyce's imagination the way that so many writers do. So as you mentioned, Francesca, very interesting that Joyce called the book Ulysses. Horrifying that lots of people now think that Ulysses was first written by James Joyce rather than having appeared in previous literature. Really interesting also that he in a way might have called it Hamlet. I think Jo Johnson in her edition makes that very, very witty point. There are lots of discussions of Shakespeare, lots of discussions of the play Hamlet itself. In some ways, Stephen Dedalus, you might think, actually plays lots of Shakespearean roles if you look at his mind in his thought processes carefully, but certainly Hamlet is one of them. You'll find no stone unstoned if you look carefully through Ulysses. I mean, I think we were mentioning over the email today, of course, as well as being the day when we're recording this podcast for Joyce's birthday is in fact Burns Night. And actually, you know, I'm not going to bore your listeners with it right now, but there's a fascinating relationship between James Joyce and Burns that we could go into over a haggis later, if you like.
That won't bore our listeners. That is genuinely fascinating.
Well, I mean, you know, there's an episode in a library, right? And as we all know, because we've all had the pleasure of certain, you know, different levels of contact with the academic world and with the world of libraries, there's one thing librarians love to do is to talk. And they're locked in this non-talking space. In Ulysses, the librarians get to talk. You know, there's a really great literary discussion that takes place in the National Library of Ireland. And one of the characters who crops up in John's book in interesting ways in relation to the reception of Ulysses, a man called William McGee, W.K. McGee, who wrote under the pseudonym John Eglinton. Joyce obviously thought he was a little bit of a kind of Presbyterian, a little bit of a Scot. So there's a moment where he gives you an inner stream of consciousness, which has a kind of Burnsian flavour. In relation to Eglinton, I think he imagines Eglinton's father as this kind of wildly authoritarian figure who Eglinton is trying to kind of behave well in order to appease. So it's an opportunity for Joyce to both show Stephen as a character whose this mind is crammed with literary allusions, but can, in his inner monologue, and of course in witty comments that he makes in his own voice, can lampoon the people around him by staging them in some of those texts as they appear in his imagination. There's no stone unstoned.
I was going to say every reader brings their own knowledge to Ulysses and finds echoes that are there. It's interesting that Richard mentioned Sterne. Absolutely, I totally agree in his presence. And then what you also notice, however, is somewhat the absence of the traditional English novels. Like Joyce famously said, the English novel had nothing to offer him. So if we're talking about, you know, material that he draws on, it's poets, dramatists like Shakespeare, like Ibsen. You mentioned Burns. And then for the novel, very much we go to France and we think of Flaubert, or we go to Italy and we think of the early D'Annunzio as being key influences on Joyce. So he casts his net very, very wide. And you know, he tries to move beyond the English novel and to try and expand the novel in English as best he can. He also famously said that having to write in English itself was the most ingenious torture ever invented. So we can see why he's pushing English and the English novel to its limits, the English language and the English novel to their limits in Ulysses, and even more, of course, in Finnegan's Wake.
I mean, part of that ingenious torture, if I can if I can dive in there, is in a way for many readers created in the episode of Ulysses, which most reflects perhaps his fascination with the history of the English language and the history of English writing, which, as John says, you know, is by no means the kind of direct relationship with the previous generation of novelists that you might expect a novelist to engage in. But he's fascinatingly interested in prose, you know, the history of prose, right back to the beginning of the English language and before in that episode. You know, what do you normally talk about in a maternity hospital is a question I sometimes start off classes on this episode by putting to my students, and they come up with things that you might normally talk about in a maternity hospital. And yeah, of course, in some ways, the conversation in the maternity hospital is about those things. It's about the politics of childbirth, for instance, in different kinds of cultures, obviously a key issue in relation to Ireland specifically, and its, you know, challenges with modernity, let's say, in the 20th century in that area. But it's a discussion which is conducted in this language which might be medieval romance, it might be the diary style of the 17th century, it might be the prose fictions of the 18th century or the 19th century, you know, the reader. Even the senior academic reader or the kind of super brilliant Oxbridge undergraduate, I think probably has a sense of just OMG, you know, a sense of absolute amazement at what goes on in that chapter, because they think they're experts in English literature, but they realise that Joyce, with all of his complex relationship to the history of English literature, is somehow well ahead of them in his knowledge. You know, everybody's in Ulysses, but lots of them are in the Oxen of the Sun episode of Ulysses. If you could do do a course in English literature, which was based on the material in the Oxen of the Sun episode in Ulysses, you'd have an amazing course in the history of English literature that very few universities in the world would now dream of presenting to their students.
Yeah, so early on in the book, Stephen Dedalus, I think it is him, describes Irish art as being like the cracked looking class, or it might be. So your book, John, Consuming Joyce, 100 Years of Ulysses in Ireland, talks about its reception in Ireland as like a product and a creation of Irish national identity in a way, because nowadays, if you go to Dublin, there's Bloomsday, there are probably Joyce-themed shops, Joyce-themed tours, everything is quite commercial about it. Mm-hmm. At what point did Ireland change from being kind of perhaps on Catholic grounds, opposed to the text or scared by it or worried by it, to accepting it as a part of kind of national identity?
Okay, a very slow process. There were immediately a number of enlightened readers who saw the importance of Joyce's Ulysses, who saw it as a reflection on the country as it was, and maybe as a vision of what the country might be in the future. So I think Ulysses presents a much more open Ireland to the Ireland that took shape in the 20s and 30s. And remember, Ulysses and the state of Ireland are the same age. 1922, we're celebrating the centenary this year of that small event as well. And the Ireland that grew up was very different to the Ireland that Joyce suggests in Ulysses, where we have a Dublin full of foreign people who are quite prominent, who are getting on, but who are also, like Leopold Bloom, the victims of, you know, nationalism and fear because they're different, that kind of thing. So Ulysses, it got more difficult rather than easier in the 20s and 30s for Ulysses to be accepted. And then Joyce died, of course, in 1941. And this was a great relief to many Irish writers, because while they appreciated Joyce, they also felt the weight of what he had achieved and that they could never really respond to that in any effective way. They felt dwarfed by him. So I think the fact that he got off the stage in 1941 made it easier to begin to celebrate him in some way. And 1954 becomes a key event, the first Bloomsday that's organized at the Joyce Tower out in Sandy Cove, and that features really important contemporary writers like Patrick Kavanagh, the poet, and Flann O'Brien. And it basically was a drunken pilgrimage. But it was five or six writers, and when it was neither popular nor profitable, who went out of their way to celebrate Joyce, to claim Joyce, and to make a statement about his importance to the country and its identity and its literature. And of course, that was greeted with hilarity and indifference, I suppose, in newspapers and official circles. But it did lay the way towards what happened in the 60s, when the Joyce Tower in Sandy Cove became a museum, thanks to the work of some of those figures and others. And gradually it became more acceptable to talk about Joyce. At the same time, again, at the end of the 60s, tragically, 7 Eccles Street, the home of Leopold and Molly Bloom, was torn down, and the city was indifferent. Demolition Ireland had its way, and we were not only demolishing a beautiful old Georgian building, but perhaps the most iconic address in Irish literature, or maybe one of the most iconic addresses in world literature. So we get, on the one hand, appreciation, and on the other hand, that not translating itself into preservation of a cultural heritage, which I suppose begins around 1982, the centenary of Joyce's birth, when finally even his old school, a Jesuit school, Belvedere College, claims Joyce as someone to be proud of among their former students. Because famously, when Joyce had died in 1941, they had not mentioned it. They had printed an obituary of his very less distinguished brother Charles, but not a word about James. 1982, we finally get a book by a Jesuit priest, James Joyce's School Days. And that's a sign that Joyce is beginning to move towards, I think, a more acceptable situation in Ireland. And then 2004, the centenary of the day in which Ulysses takes place, becomes a huge extravaganza, a Bloomsday festival that goes on for months, and which is backed up by the fact that the state has now invested 18 or 20 million pounds or euros on buying Ulysses manuscripts. And in a sense, this project, which they like to go on about, bringing Joyce home. Well, they brought home several of his manuscripts. And so now somebody who is interested can go to the National Library and consult these amazing documents. But alongside of that, there was the carnival part of it. There was the Bloomsday part of it. There was the desire to use Joyce as this cultural tourist magnet, which we still see today. You know, he is our secular saint. He is Saint James of Drumcondra, or wherever it is he's from, which I think the country uses unashamedly. And what we need to do is to ensure that all of that's fine, but let's actually also read books, and let's not just empty him and turn him into this icon, which I fear at times Ireland does.
Yeah, can I jump in there and just thank you for this great book that you've written, John, which gives such a fascinating history of this reception, and is just full of really amazing voices that are often forgotten from that debate. I mean, I think outside of Ireland, it's often very hard to realise quite the difficulty that lots of people in Ireland had in recognising Joyce as a great Irish writer. You know, all of the kinds of problems that played into that debate. And I think, you know, I learned an enormous amount from reading your book of the nuances of those positions, the particular individuals involved. And even though, of course, when anybody says anything negative about Joyce, it kind of gets me a little bit angry and cross. I was struck, I think, throughout the book, and I guess maybe it was because you chose your quotation so well, that even those people who were saying really mean things about James Joyce and about Ulysses, and we've got this lovely vision in the book of the kind of political football he becomes at various decades of Irish history, they were saying pretty interesting things, and they were putting them in an interesting way. And you know, I was struck again and again by Joyce's capacity to make his opponents almost as eloquent at times as his supporters, from from the story that you were telling here. So thank you, you know, for giving us that book.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. I mean, the book could have been at least twice the length that it is. There is so much material, and Joyce might have complained that when he sent review copies to Ireland, nobody even opened them. It's not true. There were quite a lot of people taking notice of Joyce in Ireland, many of them for all the wrong reasons, because he struck terror into their souls, and particularly some of the religious material that you'll see in various magazines. But quite the opposite. He was certainly not ignored. He was very much relevant to the debate, more than perhaps he himself even realized. And just the efforts to keep him off the curriculum, I think in itself says a lot about an Ireland which was changing. And that became clear to me really as I went through the project, that just reading Joyce down through the decades is a way also of reading Ireland as it finally began to belatedly grow up.
It's really interesting that the book's called Consuming Joyce, because Ulysses is a book in which a lot of meals are eaten in quite a horribly described way. Why did you go for consuming rather than reading?
Yeah, well, because I gave a lot of thought to the title, and of course you want to get a title that's going to be of some interest. Consuming in the sense that he became an object for consumers. He becomes, you know, an economic object, if you like, for the country. By consuming Joyce, in some way you're consuming Irish culture and Ireland. But also the idea that you cannot fully consume a work like Ulysses. That's the beauty of it. You can never finish it. It's not like sitting down to a dinner and it's done and you throw it out. That's why we're still here talking about Ulysses. It's one of those books, isn't it, Richard? We just keep coming back to it and it keeps giving us new stuff. It's never the same the second time around. And I suppose, you know, we refused to consume it for a long time in Ireland, and now we pretend to consume it to some extent. And yes, there are a body of readers who do and who read it very carefully in reading groups or on their own or whatever. But we're never going to use it up. I think Joyce is almost infinite in what his last two books in particular can offer us. And you never get to the bottom of them. That's the beauty of a great work of art, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. No.
So if John has written so eloquently and talked about the history of Joyce being appreciated in Ireland, one of the most famous photos of Ulysses ever is it being read by Marilyn Monroe. Do you want to talk about its relation to, well, how it's been consumed perhaps elsewhere around the world other than out in Ireland, or what else it's had an influence on?
Wow, what a question. Absolutely. One of the great things about let's say consumption of Joyce, John has described it, is that it is a global phenomenon, and it's a phenomenon which spreads outside of, let's say, many of the typical areas of literary or cultural consumption. So Joyce isn't just in the bookstore, because you can't really just read Ulysses by yourself on your own. He's in the reading groups, he's in the universities. And Joyce isn't just an object to be studied and written about in the educational context. The cultural impact of Joyce is huge, and it's huge around the world. I'm quite lucky. I get invited to all sorts of places. I went to Georgia, to Tbilisi in Georgia, just before lockdown, when we were still able to travel. And we were talking about James Joyce and the world. I won't say that Ireland was completely ignored, but we were talking about the locality of Tbilisi and Georgia, and the way in which Joyce had impacts on the fiction writing community and the academic community in Georgia. And we were talking about the way in which Joyce's works imagine and construct the world. An iconic photo, as you say, Marilyn Monroe reading Ulysses. I can remember the first time I saw the photo, I was kind of shocked, because it seemed to represent a strange kind of doubleness, really. That we imagine a book like Ulysses to be in the library, to be studied and appreciated by eminent professors from Italy and Yorkshire. And yet here's a picture of a young woman reading it on a roundabout, apparently in a playground, in a swimming costume. Interesting itself as a way of thinking about the young modern woman, newly empowered reader of the post-Second World War 20th century. And of course, that wasn't just any woman, that was Marilyn Monroe. So how on earth did Marilyn Monroe's world of popular culture, being an actress, but also being an iconic photographic model in that post-Second World War era, how did that impact that sense of a culture in which everybody recognizes somebody like Marilyn Monroe? She means something to everybody. How did that impact on Ulysses, and how might Ulysses have impacted on that? So here in this picture, you have a photograph of Marilyn Monroe. She's reading the final episode of Ulysses. If you get your Sherlock Holmes hat and you have a little think, oh, what's going on in this photo? What kind of reader is she? So first time I saw the photo, I was fascinated by it. I wrote to Eve Arnold and asked her about the photographer, asked her about the circumstances of the photo. She explained, you know, when Marilyn read the book, how Marilyn read the book. I was just fascinated in how you'd fit in an activity like reading Ulysses in the busy schedule that somebody like Marilyn must have had. And I think it's very inspiring for my students, you know, when they've got piles and piles of things to read. And I now say, next week we're doing Ulysses. they can look to somebody like Marilyn and realize you can fit it in. You know, you can find a way of reading this book.
Quite the time, yeah. Yeah. But also Richard, we should remember that when you're making films, there's a lot of time spent sitting around. And I think that picture is around the time of The Misfits. And the director there is, of course, John Huston, who famously went on and directed the film, the wonderful film of the day, and who was one of the main sponsors in Ireland of the Joyce Tower Museum in Sandy Cove. So he was a really convinced Joycean. So I suspect that he might have been, you know, guiding Marilyn in some way through that reading. You know, every one of us needs help to get through Ulysses. Maybe there's a connection there. But isn't it amazing what you're saying about the world recognizing Joyce? And that's what was driving so much officialdom mad in Dublin. You know, the French were discovering Joyce, the Americans were discovering Joyce, and for the Irish, they didn't understand anything. Of course, only the Irish could understand Joyce. And yet that's so wrong. We understand one version of Joyce and we can correct mistakes. But I mean, you can read Joyce in an entirely legitimate and different way in Las Vegas or in Georgia, as you say, in Tbilisi. And isn't that's, you know, I concentrate on the Irish reaction, but like that's only a small fraction. We like to think it's the most important fraction. It's only a fraction of Joyce's reception around the world, which we're still figuring out, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's an amazing ongoing story, and it's a story, you know, not just about influence within literature. It's, I guess, a story that, you know, when you said about Joyce being like Bloom, in a sense, a kind of advertising man, I would say it's a story, and John was talking about, you know, Ulysses not being a novel in the tradition of the novels that were there immediately around him. It's a story of the way in which Ulysses breaks the mold of fictional discourse, you know, you might like to say, to open up and let in all these other aspects of culture that we know to be important, but we don't necessarily find expressed or communicated through the novel as a discourse as it was in the 1920s. You know, you had to break the bounds of the novel to really write a book of modernity in 1922. That I think is, you know, enduringly the amazing thing about
about Ulysses. And you know, here we are, we're sitting in Westminster. I should think about 20 or 30 yards away from where Clarissa Dalloway in Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway lives. And you know, even before 1922, as John was saying, the reception of Ulysses had begun. And Virginia Woolf, writing about the early episodes that were appearing in the Little Review and also in the Egoist magazine in London, looked at the novelists that were around, you know, the Goldsworthies and the Bennets, and said, you know, these are now old fashioned. What we've now got is a new kind of novel, and this new kind of novel is being produced by this man, Mr. James Joyce, who she says is spiritual. Mr. Joyce is spiritual. Extraordinary idea to describe Joyce. And of course, you know, you'll of course get lots of academics have told the story of, let's call it, Woolf's kind of varying response to Joyce. That was before Ulysses was censored in the Nausicaa episode incident that John was talking about. And, you know, Woolf herself was a little bit uneasy about some of the what she felt was kind of vulgarity or over-explicitness of the Joycean representation of sexuality. But nevertheless, you know, she saw and she announced this complete novelty that this book represented in an extraordinary way, and then wrote, you know, a novel like Mrs. Dalloway, where Clarissa lives in her interiority. She goes for Leopold Bloom-like walks, you know, from where we're sitting right now to Bond Street, across Green Park, to the chemist shop, like Bloom goes to in Dublin. You know, of course, Woolf's legacy and Woolf's transformation of the novel in her fiction is, you know, a magnificent story of 1922 and modernity all of its own. But it'd be wrong to say that Joyce isn't a part of that story as well.
Yeah, we can only hope that in another 100 years, people will still be talking about Joyce and what other things he's influenced. I think we probably have to wrap up in a couple of minutes, but I have one last question. We talked a second ago about A Film of the Dead. What films have there been of Ulysses?
There are some films of Ulysses. I don't know if you're watching Hidden Assets on the BBC at the moment, with the fantastic Irish accent actress Angelina Ball, which is the current BBC favourite noirish, that's like noir Irish series. Angelina Ball is one of the actresses who's played the part of Molly Bloom, and you know, Sean Walter.
In fact, we have at least two and more versions. Yeah, I mean, Joyce fully was into the idea of getting Ulysses filmed. He had imagined Charles Laughton in the role of Leopold Bloom, so he'd seen, I think, Leopold Bloom in that tradition of, you know, the comedies, the Charlie Chaplins, and the, I know Chaplin comes afterwards, but that kind of tradition that we see, kind of comic character who gets into a whole series of scrapes. And then we have the film in 1967, is it, Richard? The Joseph Strick black and white Ulysses set in contemporary Dublin, because they didn't have the money to make a historic film, which I think is a fantastic attempt at the time. And of course it got banned in Ireland and elsewhere. But certainly led a lot of people, I think, by the book. And then there was Stephen Ray's more recent one, I think, where Angeline Ball plays Molly Bloom. So I absolutely can see space for Ulysses, not for one that fastidiously is loyal to what Joyce did, in the way that Joyce was not loyal to what Homer did. He did his own thing with the model, absolutely. And I think a film of Ulysses should be equally free as Joyce was with his source if you like, his source material, and then all the space in the world.
Absolutely. Not? But we need another one. I think it's, that's definitely the moral of the story, isn't it? And Ulysses is not the kind of book that's going to exhaust reading, but it's certainly not going to exhaust adaptation either. And yeah, film adaptation, absolutely. But think about all of the other kinds of creative engagement that there are with Joyce's text. You know, we've been talking earlier about one of my favorites, I think well overdue for a revival, which is Anthony Burgess's musical comedy Blooms of Dublin, which is itself an extraordinary phenomenon, which of course not everybody would think of as an entirely faithful record of Ulysses as it is. But nevertheless, it's hard to find, hard to imagine a writer whose creative engagement with his source text is more exuberant and more committed and more passionate than Burgess's was with Joyce. So, I don't think we've got to the end of those kinds of creative engagements with Joyce's text. And it'd probably take 100 years to get to the end of describing all the ones that we've already had.
Well, hopefully there'll be many more to come as well, especially the centenary year. Thank you so much. It was so brilliant to talk to both of you. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.